Well, this weekend, we, as a country, we honor the worker, and we prayed today for those who are engaged in everyday tasks, Monday through Friday, and many on the weekends as well. We recognize that they are valuable, and what they do is honorable and significant, whether they be nurses or accountants or homemakers or fast food cashiers or hospital volunteers or engineers or factory workers or teachers. Of course, the reality is that we sometimes don't feel that our work is significant. Do I have a witness in the house today? You ever feel that way? I know I certainly do. Sometimes go through a portion of a week or a stretch and just think, wow, I'm spinning my wheels here, or what I thought was accomplished, I'm having to go back and start over. And sometimes we can feel as if our work is not significant. Maybe it's even because of who you work for. And your employer or the company you work for is a secular company. Maybe the owner is completely godless, and you just have the sense that you're just advancing the cause of this godless person through your work. Or maybe you're in a cubicle and there's no windows and you're working on crunching numbers and you don't really see or sense how that helps people. Maybe you're in an algebra class and you know for certain that you're not going to pursue a career in mathematics, and this just seems like a waste of time, right? You can attach the scenarios. We've all felt that way at different times in our lives, that our work was not significant. And of course, you're not alone if you feel that way. Thinking about Elijah, the prophet. And he had that great victory, you might remember, on Mount Carmel against the prophets of Baal. And God brought down fire and consumed the sacrifice. But just within a matter of hours, Elijah is in deep depression. For even though God showed up, the nation of Israel had refused to turn back to God, had refused to turn from their sin. And Elijah goes off into the wilderness, and he actually has suicidal thoughts. He expresses to God, he says, "I've had enough. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. Add me to the list of prophets who had not been able to turn Israel from their sin." And he just felt as if his life was of no value. His ministry was in vain. John Calvin, a great reformer, expressed this sentiment in his dying hour. He said, "All that I have done has been of no value. The wicked will gladly seize on this word, this admission, but I repeat it again, all that I have done is of no value." David Livingston, instrumental in bringing the gospel into the interior of Africa. Now, Livingston did a lot more than just missions work. He ended up being a little bit more of an explorer later in his life and made a number of geographical, significant cultural discoveries. But after 23 years on the field of Africa, he wrote this. He said, "All that I have done has only opened up the African slave trade. The mission societies bear no fruit after 23 years of labor, and all work seems to be in vain. I have labored in vain." Perhaps one of our greatest fears is that our work will not endure, that it will not last, that we're not involved in something that is really meaningful and enduring. So it catches our attention here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, when Paul writes and says that his work, his labor, was not in vain, that it was worthwhile, that it was significant, that it was effective. So let's just look at this opening verse, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1. "For you yourselves know, brothers, that our coming to you was not in vain." Now, we want to learn from Paul today about how we can live and work in such a way that we can say that our work was worth it. It was meaningful. It was effective. And we want to learn from Paul's example today. I want to just step back just for a moment here and think about what's going on in the letter. Last week we began in 1 Thessalonians and we spent our time in chapter 1. And there we considered, Paul considered, the transformation of the Thessalonian believers. A number of people had responded to the gospel and their lives had been turned upside down. And Paul just goes on and points out the very clear evidences that these people had really received the gospel. And we challenged ourselves to think about that. Does my life evidence genuine gospel transformation? So that was chapter 1. And then as Paul moves into chapter 2, he kind of steps back and considers this whole gospel encounter from the other side. Now he considers and reflects on his role in speaking the gospel, in bringing the gospel to the Thessalonians. And that too is instructive for us, is it not? To think about, have our lives genuinely been transformed by the gospel? But I also have to think, am I faithfully now relaying the gospel and taking the gospel to those in my circle of influence? We've all been commanded to make disciples. Jesus issued that in our Great Commission to his followers. And so we want to think about this other side of the gospel, not just as a receiver, but as one who has, as people, as a church, who've been entrusted with the gospel and given the responsibility to take it to the world. And so we want to challenge ourselves there this morning. In these verses, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul speaks often of the gospel of God. That's his little phrase he uses, the good news of God. And he says it in slightly different ways as you move through the text. In verse 2, he uses this language of speaking or declaring. Though we've already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we have boldness in our God to declare to you. And this is a word that's generally used of informal speech. So as I am walking along with my friends in the hallway at school, as I am having lunch in the break room, as I am talking with my children, as I am having a meal with some neighbors, that I am just talking and speaking about what God has been doing in my life and the transformation that Jesus has accomplished and the forgiveness that I have received. So it should be something that's just interwoven in our life. He also uses terminology of having shared the gospel of God with them. We see this in verse 8. Being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves. And this is a word that speaks of kind of the overflow. So Paul says in Ephesians 4, he says, I want you to work so that you will have something to share with those who are in need. Yes, you need to pay your own bills. You need to hold down a job to provide for your own needs. But the goal would be that you're in a position to be able to help others out of the overflow of what God blesses you with. And that's kind of the sense here, that we ought to share the gospel, not begrudgingly, but with a spirit of joy and gratitude and recognition for all that we have received. And then he uses terminology there in verse 9 of proclamation. Oftentimes this word is translated as preached. It's an authority word. It's the work of a herald who is sent out from the king and who stands in the city square and says, hear ye, right? The king has declared. This is a strong word. We might think of this as a little bit more formal, maybe in a group setting where the gospel is preached. The good news of God is preached. So just a lot. Paul talks about it in a lot of different ways, but this is the task he was engaged in, bringing the gospel to the people of Thessalonica. And we again have a chance to think about how we can become more effective in sharing the gospel ourselves. Now we have to be clear, Paul was an apostle. So he's in a little different category. His role was different. The apostles were those who were eyewitnesses to the resurrection. In other words, they saw and touched the resurrected Jesus. So they were able to give eyewitness testimony. And they were also, the apostles had to be ones who had received their teaching directly from Jesus. Not secondhand, not thirdhand, But they actually walked with Jesus to hear all of his teaching, and then God used them to record the words of Christ in what we have in the New Testament. So Paul's an apostle. He's a little bit different category. He's single, which means he's able to give himself to ministry in an intensive and undivided way, able to travel extensively. So we're not necessarily able to emulate every part of Paul's life, but we can learn how to be more effective in sharing our faith, in sharing the gospel. We can learn from Paul's pattern and what he says about his own disciplines and his own practices when it came to sharing the gospel. So let's jump in here. What can we learn? Based on the testimony of Paul here in 1 Thessalonians 2, we should speak with boldness, knowing that God will advance his gospel even through persecution. So let's look again here at verse 2. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. So before coming to Thessalonica, Paul had been in Philippi. It was another neighboring city within that same region of Macedonia, and it was rough. Oh, if you go back to Acts 16 and read about it, Paul and his companions were arrested, stripped of their clothes, beaten with rods, imprisoned with their feet in stocks. It was all of this in response to their proclamation of the gospel. So Paul might have interpreted this as a closed door. I think I would have interpreted this as a closed door, right? I'm going back to Asia. But Paul just makes a point of it, that I came to you and I proclaimed the gospel to you even after what I endured in Philippi, and even though I had a pretty good idea of what I was going to endure in Thessalonica. I proclaimed with boldness. I didn't hold anything back. Matter of fact, this word for boldness has the idea of all words, like full disclosure, right? I mean, he didn't shrink away from declaring the gospel. I want you to just note here that the gospel is something to be spoken. It is something to be declared. It is fashionable in our day to talk about living the gospel or living out the gospel. And there is a gospel lifestyle that we ought to emulate, all right? But there's no getting around the fact that the gospel must be spoken. There is content to the gospel, as Craig rehearsed for us today. The death, burial, resurrection, return of Christ. This is the good news. Death has been defeated and salvation is available through Jesus, the Savior of the world. And until we've spoken the gospel has not been communicated. And Paul was bold to share it. In the 19th century, Johnstown, Pennsylvania was a thriving city in the Allegheny Mountains. It was full of steel mills that operated around the clock. The accounts tell us that the glow of the steel mills was kind of there all through the night, every night. And a thriving industry that was taking place there. Of course, in the Allegheny Mountains and that part of Pennsylvania, the weather could be a bit dicey. They would often have seasonal flooding at the various rivers that were coming down through the mountains. But in 1889, a series of storms brought more rain than the region had ever seen. And several miles above Johnstown was an earthen dam. And after several days of rain, some of the residents up in that remote area began to be concerned about the integrity of the dam. And they came out and did inspections, and they sent a young man by the name of John Park. They sent him on horseback through the rain to get down to the closest point of civilization where a telegraph could be sent down to Johnstown, warning them of the coming danger. And so John Park undertook this journey through the night, and he arrived mid-morning in the town of South Fork, and he addressed the crowd standing in front of George Steinman's general store. And he tried to convince them that there was real danger, that the dam was likely to give way this day. Of course, no one paid much attention. The rivers flooded every year. Telegraph operators were unsure whether to really pass along this alarmist report. But John Park fulfilled his duty, didn't he? He did what he knew he must have done and what he was charged to do. And he spoke it with boldness in the face of a good deal of skepticism there in the town of South Fork. And we too ought to boldly share the gospel as if lives depended on it, because they do. We ought to be confident, as Paul was, of God's empowering presence. Paul wasn't bold because he felt like he was so eloquent or he was so knowledgeable or he had all the answers. The text here in verse 2 says that we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God. So he was confident that God was going to use his words, even in the context, what didn't seem like a real hopeful audience. But he was confident that God was going to use his words, going to use his gospel to change lives. And we have that same confidence. Jesus, when he gave his commission to make disciples, he said, "I will be with you always, even to the end of the age." Sometimes we give ourselves too much credit. We don't feel like we're capable. You're not. You don't feel like we have all the answers. You don't. But God has promised his presence with you when you share the message of hope in the gospel. Number two, we should be more concerned with pleasing God than with pleasing or impressing people. We should be more concerned with pleasing God than with impressing people. Let's look to verse 3. "For our appeal does not spring from error or impurity or any attempt to deceive, but just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please man, but to please God, who tests our hearts. For we never came with words of flattery, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness." So Paul understood that the nature of his ministry was a sacred trust. God had entrusted Paul with this message. Paul was, in a very real way, he was an apostle. He was a sent one. And he knew he would answer to God for the way he carried out his task. Based on his experience in Philippi, again, Paul had a pretty good sense that he was likely to be rejected by many in Thessalonica. But that did not deter Paul, because he was not concerned with pleasing people. He had a duty to perform, just like our friend John Park had a duty to perform. It didn't matter that no one listened to the message. Paul was duty-bound to speak it, knowing that he would answer to God. And that reality, that sense of wanting to just please God and just serve and speak in obedience to him, shaped Paul's ministry. Paul gives a number of statements here about his ministry, all of them stated negatively. That the appeal of the gospel was not based on unreliable information. It was not based in error. It did not come from error. Paul says, "I'm not expressing wives' tales here. I'm not just telling you some legend that I heard down, you know, at the local bar. You know, I'm telling you word that has come directly from Jesus himself. God has revealed himself." And so it didn't come from error. The appeal of the gospel is not associated with impurity. This is a word that speaks to sexual impurity specifically, and most likely in the context of the temple and the Roman worship and the pantheons and the temples of that day. It was temple prostitution and various sorts of things that were associated with worship. And Paul said, none of those things are a part of what we are accomplishing. It was not made by means of manipulation. The appeal was not made by means of manipulation. Paul says, I didn't use clever speech. I didn't try to emotionally secure a response. I didn't try to be clever. I just, in a very straightforward way, presented the gospel. The appeal of the gospel was not sweetened by flattery. Paul spoke out of conviction. He didn't dodge the reality of sin and the certainty of judgment. If he wanted to gain a crowd, there would have been better ways. But he didn't tell people what they wanted to hear. He told people what they needed to hear. It was a sense of weight and credibility that came with Paul's message. And the appeal of the gospel was not motivated by greed. He wasn't a huckster come to town to try to profit from the people. A matter of fact, he was sacrificing to bring them the message. John Park rode through the night on that horse to get down to South Fork. There's nothing in it for him other than to warn the people. And Paul says in a similar way, I'm not gaining anything by this. I just want you to know about God's good news. As I thought about this, I was reminded of a couple characters in church history. Charles Finney was a preacher during the Second Great Awakening, and Finney was a bit controversial in his methods. Finney believed that the gospel was to be proclaimed, but that you also needed to use means. You needed to use techniques to secure a response. And so Finney would establish a bench at the front of the auditorium, and he would have people come up. It was called the Mourner's Bench, and he would pick out certain people to come up and sit, and he would preach directly at them, and you never knew when you would be the next one asked to come up and sit in the mourner's bench, right? I mean, there was this emotional pressure that was brought to bear, and C.H. Spurgeon, another contemporary preacher of the day, took issue with that methodology. He said, I don't want you responding in some wave of emotion because there's this sense of energy in the room and other people are responding. He says, if God's bringing conviction into your heart, we've established an inquiry room where you can go and you can talk to someone and they'll lead you to understand the gospel. But Spurgeon didn't want any emotional manipulation. And Paul seems to be saying something similar here. I think there's something here for us to hear as well. The gospel is not to be peddled or negotiated. We don't have the prerogative to soften the message, to make it more palatable. We dare not try to get a group of children to repeat after me and in a group context and try to get people to pray a prayer without genuine conviction and conversion. And so we certainly see that as a mark of Paul's ministry that he draws our attention to. We should communicate with gentleness and genuine concern. Number three, we should communicate with gentleness and genuine concern. Verse 6, nor did we seek glory from people, whether from you or from others, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ, but we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. So Paul was in a position of authority as an apostle, but he didn't wield that authority as a tyrant. He didn't insist upon deferential treatment. Rather, he exercised authority as a mother with a newborn child. He cared for them, he nurtured them, and he expressed his love and concern for them. He even said, you've become very dear to us, right? That's a great conversation starter when you're talking to somebody about the gospel. I have really appreciated you as a coworker and your pattern of work and your speech patterns, or you know, just as a friend, you've meant a great deal to me. That's a great way to begin to talk about the gospel, talk about God's offer of salvation. Certainly, our speech ought to be characterized by gentleness and compassion. Russell Moore wrote a really good little volume entitled Onward, Engaging the Culture Without Losing the Gospel. And he's very concerned about how our faith relates to political engagement and a lot of polarizing issues, certainly in that realm. He's concerned that we are more passionate about our political ideologies than we are about the advance of the gospel. We'd rather have a certain person become president than have a certain person come to faith in Christ. And this quote caught me. He said, "We must see even our most passionate critic not as an argument to be vaporized, but as a neighbor to be evangelized." May God help us to share the gospel with a spirit of gentleness and compassion. May God give us a spirit of civility. It doesn't mean we water down or soft pedal the gospel. Paul's already made that clear, right? He speaks it with boldness. But he does so with a clear respect and love for the people that he's talking to. We might have the right words, but if we don't say it in the right way, we sabotage our witness. And the scripture has a lot to say about this, about praying for our enemies, about living at peace so that people might be saved, about arguing with gentleness and respect, 1 Peter chapter 3. Number 4, we should conduct ourselves with integrity. Here, beginning in verse 9, Paul talks about his behavior, not just how he preached the gospel, but just his behavior, how he lived off hours. "For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how holy and righteous and blameless was our conduct toward you believers." So Paul points out his work ethic. He worked night and day. This is not a reference to his preaching ministry, but Paul made tents to support himself while he traveled and proclaimed the gospel. And so Paul's saying, you've seen how I've worked to earn my own way. He didn't want to be a burden on the church. He didn't want his motives to be drawn into question. And we're told that the church here was made up primarily of working middle class, a few prominent women, according to the account in Acts 17. But Paul did not want anything to burden these people. He talks about his behavior as being righteous and holy. This is terminology that speaks to abiding by the law, both God's law and human law. Might remember that he had been accused in Thessalonica of causing a riot and undermining Caesar's leadership. And Paul just wants to be very clear. I've done everything to walk according to the laws of the government and to conduct myself properly in relationship to God's laws. So he brings integrity, personal integrity, to his witness. Frederick Douglass was a former slave who gained his freedom, and then became an ardent abolitionist. He wrote about the time when he was sent to Edward Covey's farm. Edward Covey was a slave breaker. He was sent there as a young man to be broken in and to have his spirit broken so that he would toe the line when he went back to his master. And he talked about the conflict that arose in his heart during his time there. He says, "Early Sunday morning, Frederick returned to Covey's farm. When he arrived, he found Covey and his wife dressed in their Sunday best on their way to church. Covey looked kindly at Frederick, inquired how he was, and softly asked him to round up some wayward pigs." Frederick soon suspected that the Sabbath was the real reason for Covey's behavior. The compassion Covey showed Frederick on Sunday alone made more grossly apparent the true hollowness of his faith. He had more respect for the day than for the man for whom the day was mercifully given. Frederick Douglass later wrote, "For while he could cut and slash my body during the week, he would not hesitate on Sunday to teach me the value of my soul or the way of life and salvation by Jesus Christ." Frederick Douglass went on to say, "The sham of religion which everywhere prevailed cast in my mind a doubt upon all religion." May God help us that in the midst of our gospel witness, we don't undermine or impede that witness by our behavior. That we would live with integrity. Finally, we should share the whole gospel. We should share the whole gospel. Verse 11, Paul closes this section. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. It's an interesting, in one context, Paul says that he was like a mother and like a father. Here he focuses on the fact that he was like a father to them. Not just gentle as a mother, nurturing, but firm as a father. Gospel is not simply about asking a person to pray a prayer, asking God's forgiveness. The gospel also involves repentance, a turning from sin. There is a call associated with the gospel. And Paul is calling them, like a father, to walk worthy of that calling, to walk worthy of the God who saved them. Shared that with them personally, says each one. Shared it firmly. One of the words there says that he not only exhorted them and encouraged them, but he insisted, he urged. He did not take no for an answer. Obedience to Christ is not optional for the Christian. We call the gospel shared in view of God's kingdom. God is establishing a kingdom. God is not establishing a social club or an educational network. He is establishing a kingdom. And we are called to live as citizens of that kingdom. I have shared with you in the past some of the formative moments in my own childhood, but I remember as a junior high boy feeling my father's full wrath. There had been a single mom at church who was moving, and a number of people had agreed to come and help her move on a particular Saturday, and I didn't go. Another plan came up with my friends, and I didn't show for that moving expedition. And I remember being in the kitchen as my dad handed me the phone to make my call and apologize. And he was not taking no for an answer. And he did not leave the room. He said, you've not only dragged your reputation through the mud, but mine as well. And you're going to be a person of your word. And Paul is talking to them, even as he's presenting the gospel to them, he's talking to them as a father. He's challenging them with what the gospel really entails. And we should, like Paul, be committed to sharing the whole gospel. So John Park set out on horseback from the dam that morning, and he did not ride in vain. He exerted great effort to warn the people of Johnstown, and eventually the telegraph message did get through. And some heeded the warning. Of course, many did not. Over 2,000 people died as the entire city was swept away in the flood. But John Park did not ride in vain on that rainy day in 1889. And the Apostle Paul did not suffer in vain when he went to the city of Thessalonica and preached in the midst of great persecution. And if we will follow Paul's pattern of gospel proclamation, we can be sure that our labor will not be in vain. Will you stand with me as we pronounce a benediction and close in song? We leave from here to bear witness to Christ in faithfulness to the Scriptures, in harmony with the Church of the Ages, and in unity with all of Christ's people. May the love of God surround you and the wisdom of Christ guide you and the power of the Holy Spirit encourage you as you joyfully proclaim the good news of God's love.